Live Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, Chairman and Founder of the UK's integrative cancer care charity, Yes to Life, set up to help people with cancer to learn about and access integrative medicine to help them meet the many challenges of a diagnosis. Integrative medicine is the name given to the combination of mainstream cancer treatments with a broad range of complementary and lifestyle approaches designed to meet the needs of body, mind and spirit, all of which can be substantial when it comes to dealing with cancer. In the last decade, and even particularly in the last 5 years, the integrative approach has crashed in unexpectedly as a massive win for practically everyone with cancer at a low or zero cost is exercise. Generations have been brought up to believe that bed rest is always best when you're ill, so it's quite a cultural switch both for patients and healthcare professionals to take on board the idea that this advice was fundamentally flawed and that exercise is in fact one of the most potent tools for recovery from a huge range of conditions, including cancer. Scarlett Roberts is someone who has been heavily involved in the exercise revolution for many years and who's well aware of the broad and significant implications of adopting a targeted exercise regime when faced with cancer, and particularly when going through conventional cancer treatments. Today, I'm speaking to Scarlett over the internet. Hi, Scarlett. Lovely to meet you and welcome to the Yes to Life show.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having me.
So Britain has yet to catch up with the exercise for cancer revolution, and it's a sign of where we are that so few oncologists are even talking about this incredible resource for well-being and recovery. The messages we're getting are that exercise is good for everything and everyone, but I suspect this can't actually be true. Surely there must be one or two situations in which the old take it lying down advice does actually still apply.
I can't think of one.
Really?
Name one instance when exercise isn't a good thing, right? And if we're talking specifically about cancer, we know that it improves outcomes of treatment. It can actually improve the efficacy of chemotherapy. It definitely deals with the symptom management side of things. So all of the, you know, the side effects that come with chemo, we know this. I can't think of a time where we wouldn't use exercise, even on the days when you're exhausted, like days 5 to 7 after chemo, for example, when you're known to be very, very tired, there's still something you can do in terms of gentle mobilization, breathing.
Right. So exercise of some sort. What about post-surgery?
Post-surgery, right. That's slightly different. Obviously, you need to get the all clear from your physician first. Mm-hmm. And then it has to be a very graded, almost prescriptive exercise program to ensure, you know, the safe recovery from the surgery.
But otherwise, there's always something, is I think the message you're putting out.
Yeah, you can move in some way. Yeah. So because I've worked always in quite an isolated perspective, so coming from an MSK background, a musculoskeletal background, it was sort of joint and isolation, joint specific, and sort of looking at only one area of the body and honing in on that. So if I had somebody who, you know, had a knee injury, it was like, well, fine, so we work on your core. And for me, cancer is no different. So however you're feeling on that particular day, whatever symptoms you're presenting, there's some movement that could be done. And that might be as simple or as small as mobilizing your thoracic spine with some gentle breathing exercises.
Right.
Just to get your respiratory system going. But there's still movement.
Right. Okay. Something for everyone. Okay. So, as I was alluding to, the good news that exercise is good for people with cancer should have spread to everyone it applies to by now, but sadly this simply isn't true because it isn't really taken seriously by oncologists, not as seriously as, say, a costly treatment, even though it could actually be even more effective, not to mention bordering on completely free. So I think it's really important to speak about the basics. What do we know about why exercise is so beneficial both for cancer generally and specifically when undergoing conventional cancer treatments?
Exercise is good because it makes you healthier, right? It reduces your BMI. You increase your muscle mass. which means that your metabolism is higher, which means that you also, you're not just metabolizing food quicker, you're metabolizing treatment quicker. So that's something that's really important to bear in mind. But having a physically strong body, I mean, bear in mind, cancer is something that attacks the body and weakens it. And chemo is going to break that down by weakening the immune system also. So if you can be as physically strong as possible, then you're going to be able to withstand your treatment better than somebody who isn't as physically fit. We also know exercise to be, in terms of prevention, really up there with nutrition as something that is likely to decrease your likelihood of getting cancer. Prevention, however, is something that nobody thinks about, because until you've gotten something, you don't think about preventing it. But for me, prevention also falls into the remission category. So if you've had cancer and you're in remission, that's a really key point where you might look at the prevention of further cancers or a secondary cancer.
Well, it's a big point you made there. I mean, you know, we should all be interested in prevention, of course, because the statistics are absolutely shocking as to how many of us are going to get cancer in our lifetime. And we should do practically anything to avoid that, really. If we knew what the experience of cancer was like, we'd be full on it. But unfortunately, I think cancer's had such bad press that everybody's got that sort of tunnel vision of like, well, I hope it's not going to happen to me, and I don't really want to know about it if I don't have to. And so people don't. But the only thing that I think is beginning to change that is that the statistics are so high now that if you're somebody who doesn't know anybody quite close to you who's had cancer, you're remarkably unusual now. So secondhand view of what it's like going through cancer, I hope, will wake people up to being more in tune with prevention, and which, of course, is actually the answer.
Yeah, I think as well, because we're bombarded with information about all kinds of chronic disease. And so if we got involved in preventing all of them, you know, it's just too much, right? You know, every day there's a new newspaper article about, oh, we hear coffee's great for you or coffee's not great for you, or having one glass of red wine, but not four. And there's a lot of information that we have to root through and process. But I think when it comes to exercise, if everyone has in the forefront of their brain that exercise and nutrition combined are the only two things that tackle the top four. So you've got cancer, diabetes, stroke, and heart disease, right? So those are the big four all-cause mortality causations. And so if you know that exercise tackles all of those things, I think that's a good way to think about it in just general decreasing all-cause mortality.
No, you're definitely right there. I mean, there's no bad press for exercise when it comes to health, basically. It's so far it's got a clean bill in terms of being good for everything.
Yeah, to prove otherwise, right? Who went and went for a walk and then was written on a death certificate as that's called death, long walk. No.
Yeah, so that's a very good point. And as you say, nutrition can also have the same kind of support as a way of actually supporting good health. But of course, it's a lot more complicated with nutrition, because there's so much nitpicking about what good nutrition is. And there's less of that within exercise, I think. I mean, there is contentious stuff about the amount of exercise, the type of exercise, all this kind of stuff. It still goes on, but I don't think it's got anything like the history or the complexity of nutrition.
Agreed. With nutrition, I think there's a lot of contraindication with nutrition, if I'm correct. I'm not a nutritionist, so don't take this as
well. Okay.
But I think that there's contraindications in terms, if you are having traditional cancer treatments, there might be some foods that are contraindicated, or supplements, for example, that won't work so well. So you do need to have somebody who really knows what they're doing when it comes to nutrition. When it comes to exercise, I think you need somebody who knows what they're doing, but it's less, you're right, it's much less complex. There's, as long as you have somebody like yours truly who can liaise with your oncologist and your physicians and understand any potential contraindications, once we have those out the way, then we can create exercise plans according to your needs, but also your desires. Because the other key thing is that there's a mental health side of all of this. So we need to be very respectful and aware of somebody's preferred ways of moving. So if somebody hates running, I am that person. I'm very fit and very, I hate running. So if somebody prescribed running to me, I'd be like, no, I just I find it the most boring thing in the world. I also, for the record, if you see anybody running on the street, name one of them that looks happy when they're doing it. They don't. Very disappointing. Right? So I think it's important to get to the bottom of what people enjoy doing as well as good for them. And the great thing about exercise is almost anything is movement. As long as you're not lying down asleep, you're moving. So we can incorporate all kinds of things into a routine that becomes pleasant and not something that is a chore.
Excellent. So, yes, we'll probably hear from a few people who smile when they're running, who are going to protest like mad.
Ones like it's the best day of their life going, well, I love it.
Yeah, London Marathon. we'll hear from them, no doubt. But, so it's interesting. I mean, you know, I think if you're looking in the field of prevention, for example, then I think even having an expert on hand isn't necessarily, and there's no necessity for it necessarily. But with cancer, as in all disciplines that support cancer, it's much more complex, I think. And it seems to be that it's always worth having at least some level of professional support in order to get the most, if nothing else, from the particular discipline that you're looking to, even maybe to avoid possible negative consequences.
Correct. And I think as well, the creativity side of it. So I think if you're right, I mean, exercise is exercise. You don't necessarily need some expert, but if you are having cancer treatment and you're one, I think to alleviate any concerns about any negative impacts, two, I think because there's people, I think if people walk into a gym, they walk around and they're like, oh my God, it's quite an intimidating place. I personally don't work in gyms. I'm not a big fan of them in general. I just find them a bit industrial and a bit unpleasant to be in, but I can work in gyms. But I think, you know, it's overwhelming for people who aren't used to exercising. And you go, nowadays, post-pandemic, we've got so much information online, you know, free yoga, free Pilates, free everything, because everybody put it out there to help people in the pandemic who couldn't go to their community classes and to gyms and things. So I think if you are newly diagnosed and you're like, okay, what do I do? You're bombarded with so much information. And I think it's best to have somebody who, one, can get to know you, two, create something for you, like we discussed before, something that you're going to enjoy and that it's relevant to you. And also to take into account any other co-pathologies, because cancer often isn't, you know, I started working with cancer patients because I was already working with people for another reason, like back surgery or a knee replacement or sciatica or whatever. Like I say, I came from a musculoskeletal background. Cancer became a comorbidity that they would get diagnosed with a year or two into their journey with me. And so if that happens in that way, then it could happen in the other way too, right? So I think it's good to have somebody on hand who understands, you know, the cross-sectionality of that. And also for the support, you know, I think it's a very isolating place to be to have a cancer diagnosis. So to have a support network of professionals who understand it is good.
Right. And have you got some great stories about people coming along to you who've got a fundamental no to exercise? They just don't like exercise and you have to be super creative in enticing them into something.
There are people who like to be treated. And that's not just for cancer, that's for anything. So when they come to me, I'm the nemesis, right? Because I'm one of those, this happened because of you, right? Not cancer specifically, but with lots of things, it's usually pain, chronic pain, because you are doing something or you are not doing something. And people don't like to hear that it's their own fault. People like to go, where's the doctor? Where's the massage therapist? Where's the chiropractor to fix me? You know, all those kinds of things. They want to be fixed. They want to be treated. They want the cure. They don't want to know that it's in any way their own responsibility. That's some people. Other people are very proactive. The latter are my people. The former I struggle with because until they change their mindset, it's very hard. I'm not going to force them to do anything.
Right.
I'm certainly not going to take their money and watch them not do what I'm telling them to do. That's really, you know, unethical. So I think that's another time where, you know, the integrative side of it comes in, because that's when all of us work together. What's the obstacle here? And if it's one which requires counseling or therapy, then we address that first. And maybe what is the barrier there? Why do you not want to help yourself? Why would you want to just rely on everyone else, like the chemo and the oncologists and the treatments and so on? Do you not want to be a participant in your own recovery instead of just a patient? And yeah, that's a whole mindset in itself. And I can encourage that to a point, but there are again, experts in that field who will get to the bottom of what's going on there. What's the barrier? Okay.
So sometimes somebody else is needed, a bit of input from somewhere else.
I don't think any of us in this area of cancer or cancer treatments or integrative approaches, none of us are the oracle here. Like you say, it's a deeply complex pathology and it requires lots of different brains. And sometimes I'm just not the person. It could be another exercise instructor. It's also about relationships with
characters, yeah.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz, life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so you describe yourself as providing clinical Pilates. I think most people nowadays have got some idea at least what Pilates looks like, but I'm guessing you call it clinical because it's not just general exercise, you know, for health and well-being, but it's very specific exercise targeted at particular conditions. Is that a good
description? Correct, yeah. So I trained like anybody else, and my first studio space was from a physiotherapy practice. So I immediately took patient referral from the practice. So immediately my entire client base was a list of patients who had, you know, diagnosed pathologies, or maybe they were rehabbing post-surgery, maybe they were trying to avoid surgery, and we're looking at what we call conservative management. So it was working in a very prescriptive way in a clinical setting. So when I say clinical Pilates, I'm looking at somebody in a very in a very isolated way. I'm not giving you a whole body workout. I'm looking at what's the problem and how do we create a plan to fix that or to manage it. Right. Is often more the case nowadays. It used to be if somebody had a knee injury, we were looking at fixing it. Now with all the comorbidities and everything, it's like, we're just going to manage you, you know, a long-term management plan that gives people the opportunity to self-manage their own pain, their own pathologies. And again, the pandemic has shown us an enormous amount about being proactive in your healthcare. And I'm a big fan of saying being a participant and not a patient. So that's what I mean about clinical, in a clinical setting and in a clinical method. I'm addressing your pain points in a methodical way that is not just, okay, here's some stretches and here's, you know, some core exercises. I'm looking at what's wrong, why, how do we relieve the pain, and then how do we stop it from happening again?
Okay, that's clear. So it's quite an unusual area you've ended up working in. I mean, you'd like to tell us how you got there. Have you always been involved in exercise and movement?
Well, I'm an ex-ballet dancer, and like all ballet dancers, you are unemployed a lot. And honest to God, I was a terrible waitress. So I was like, every time I'd finish an amazing contract on some amazing stage and it'd be my last performance and curtain comes down and the next morning you wake up with this huge low of like, now I've got to go and work in a bar. And I've got to remember how awful the general public are, how awful hospitality is in general. And I went through the cycle so many times. I was my own worst enemy. You know, they say, the definition of a fool is repeating the same
they do
thing,
say that
expecting a different outcome. And every time I'd be like, this restaurant will be different, and every restaurant is no different because you're still serving people who generally just should never be served. Sorry to anyone that goes to restaurants. So I decided, I was like, well, what should I do instead? Do something else instead. And I think Pilates is just a natural progression for dancers. Well, especially for ballet dancers, we do Pilates as a prevention management mm-hmm. for injury. Also recovery from injury if we did get injured. And it's still movement. And I was always very fascinated by anatomy and physiology and in the science side of it, as well as just the artistry and movement that comes from being a dancer. I was much more fascinated by the mechanics and the functionality of the body as well. Mm. Going to be a Pilates teacher. And then I got a job in the West End. So I was like, okay, well, let's park that.
Right.
West End, then went back to Pilates, and that was that. And then, like I say, my studio was from a physio practice, so all just went navigate funneled down into this clinical setting, and a setting in which I've never moved away from. And even in the pandemic, when all the clinical work, you know, shut down because obviously, you know, everything did, I still managed to navigate it to the corporate world and their sort of prescriptive needs during the pandemic, working from home and looking at, instead of just giving generic classes to corporations, looking at, well, what's your problem? You know, if you're sitting on your bed, working on your laptop, you know, we'll address neck pain, back pain, and so on.
Hmm.
I'm just very fascinated with using exercise to treat, to support recovery. It's going to be used for literally anything.
Yeah. But you, as you say, you kind of morphed into cancer just because of some of your clients happened
where
to go
are we
there.
Now? Yeah, where are we now? It's 1 in 2 people get cancer, right?
Absolutely.
50% of the population, that's 50% of my list at any time, are going to present with cancer. Why wouldn't I, you know, and research and investigate and understand better how I can best support them? I am not, like I said before, I'm not the oracle on anything, but what I can do is be like a sponge and read and absorb all the available information and transpose that in a way that makes sense to a patient. Because it's also, like I say, very overwhelming, and there's a lot of jargon, and there's a lot of, you know, doctors love speaking in doctor speak.
They do.
And
yeah, that's a general geek problem in the world, isn't it? Geeks like speaking geek, and nobody else understands them. They like that, actually. They're quite.
You know what? I think if I were that clever, maybe I would only speak in my own special language too.
Right, could be. Maybe that's it. So coming back to the reasons for incorporating exercise into a personal program for cancer, I want to talk about some of the big physical wins of exercise. So starting with that all too common life destroyer, fatigue. Do you want to say something about exercise and fatigue?
Yes. So exercise is great for, if we're talking chronic fatigue, I mean, first of all, building muscle mass is going to combat fatigue because you're a physically stronger structure that you're basing, you know, your body on. It also releases, you know, all the good hormones, all the endorphins that we hear so often, all the good ones, the serotonin, you know, all the adrenaline, all those things that combat the hormones that induce fatigue, which would be stress-based hormones, cortisol, and so on. So it's a hormonal issue as well as a physical strength issue. And the stronger you are, we talked about metabolism, so your metabolism increases, so your body is more, it's just more functioning, it's more awake, it's more work, it's working better. And that's how exercise tackles fatigue. And also the mental, the psychology of it, you know, to bring yourself to exercise in some way, shape, or form every day brings your brain into a better space. I mean, you and I are going to speak a bit more about why I'm specifically interested in the trauma aspect of cancer, and that obviously involves a big part of it is fatigue and so on, and all the domino effects of the trauma.
Yeah, they're all linked together. Absolutely right. Now, cancer patients have to suffer pain for various different reasons. There's lots of reasons that cancer patients go through pain, including they might have had surgery, they might have got neuropathy, which is, you know, it's a horrible thing in the ends of your fingers and toes. How can it help in those kind of instances?
It's just specifically in the case of neuropathy, we exercise increases blood flow, increases blood flow through the vascular system. So by increasing the blood flow to the extremities, you're going to lessen the physical pain that you experience from the neuropathy. And with joint pain, again, mobilizing. So there's very specific stretches that can be done, gentle mobilization exercises, muscle stretches as well. There's a lot that can be done in terms of mobilization and joint-specific strengthening that will help reduce pain. And again, that's not specific just to cancer. That's across the board with anybody suffering from pain. So it's basically just reapplying the same principles, but in a slightly more prescriptive way for cancer patients.
Interesting. So somebody who's on long-term treatment, say hormonal treatment, that has a side effect of joint pain, then an exercise program would be a good thing to do long-term in order to combat that.
Yeah. General joint pain is almost guaranteed to be reduced by strengthening around the joint. If something is stronger, it can't be in more pain. To be able to solidify and strengthen the joint and keep it as mobile as possible, to be able to use it to the greatest range that, you know, that joint has, the capacity that it has, is the best thing that you can do for your joints.
Okay. So, you know, probably the biggest practical thing that patients are looking for support with is the treatment outcome, of course, like, you know, how long they live and how good it is. Can you say something about exercise in relation to that?
Yeah, there's been only more recent studies, actually, but there was a big study done, and the greatest finding that they had was that some aerobic combined with some resistance exercise several times per week actually improved the efficacy of the treatment. Like, the treatment outcomes were better. And that's got to be a game changer. So if you could just sit chemo, or you can combine it with quite a specific graded exercise program, knowing that the chances of you surviving are better, I don't think there's any argument there that you wouldn't go ahead and look to exercise through your treatment.
Fundamentally, that's the message we'd like all oncologists in the UK to wake up to, isn't it? This is actually a great thing for their patients to be doing without any change to their treatment regime whatsoever.
I think it's, why aren't we doing it? It's a good question. It's a question we're all asking, isn't it? Why aren't we doing it? There is a handful of oncologists, oncologists that you and I both know, that are big on integrative care for cancer. And it's been proven over and over that it's the best approach. No one's suggesting that you replace conventional treatment with just a bit of exercise and some supplements. By the complete opposite, we're saying exercise all of your resources, you know, use your whole basket of weapons here, and, you know, use the ammunition that you have.
Right. It's and of course, the very interesting work in this field being done in Australia, which has got much more high-level buy-in, I think, than we have over here. You know, they have, you know, exercise suites in the chemotherapy unit, you know, and they've done immense trials. And the message over there has definitely got out. All right. So I was specific there in asking about physical wins, in order to distinguish those from another whole arena in which I understand exercise can also be hugely beneficial, to our mental, emotional and spiritual well-being. So this is an area that Yes to Life's been exploring in some detail recently, although not so far given quite so much attention to the role of exercise. So in fact, a lot of people might be thinking simply, well, you know, what's exercise got to do with all that? Well, maybe you can tell us.
So I'm looking at this from a quite specific trauma aspect. Okay. So if we can define trauma as a group of symptoms experienced by those who are overwhelmed by horror and helplessness, there's a very lay way of putting it, but if I could put it in a sentence, that would be it. Trauma is held in the body in the form of a lack of coordination. It could be stunted speech, lack of flow in a conversation, or as well as physical and joint pain and raised heart rate. So we know unequivocally that trauma manifests physically in the body. So in the same way that cancer treatment affects the body, the trauma aspect of having your cancer diagnosis will also impact your body in a physical way. Now, currently, we're only addressing trauma with talking therapies and medication.
If at all.
Well, if that's available to you, well done. So it begs the question, well, if there's so many physical symptoms, why aren't we addressing it physically with the body in the same way with cancer treatment? If there's so many physical symptoms, why aren't we looking at moving the body, right? So if we look at how this trauma comes about, because it helps us better understand the body's response. So you have the amygdala, which is your kind of alarm system. It's the subcortical, you know, alarm system there. It detects your innate, pre-hardwired, prehistoric, you know, fight or flight response. And it's driven by emotion, and it's triggered by usually threat to life. So we can easily associate that with a cancer diagnosis. There's a
absolutely.
It's not an immediate one, but it's still, the threat is there.
Psychologically, it's a threat to your life. Straight away, as soon as you hear the word associated with you, yeah?
Yeah.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
And then on top of that, you've got the prefrontal cortex, which is the sort of, it's a kind of watchtower of everything. So whilst you've got the amygdala that gives you the immediate threat and alerts you to that, the prefrontal cortex sort of hovers above it a bit more objectively and assesses, okay, it rationalizes it. It inhibits the extreme emotion and rationalizes it a bit more so that you have a more regulated state. So for example, if there was, you could smell smoke, your amygdala would go, oh, is there a fire? Am I going to burn alive? But your prefrontal cortex will go to the kitchen and go, no, I've burnt the toast. And so you would immediately regulate your emotional state, and therefore your physical body would relax and you would have no visceral reaction to the burnt toast, because your brain has been able to go, oh, it's just burnt toast. I'm not going to burn alive in this house.
Okay.
Neuroimaging, i.e. MRI scanning, has shown us that fear, sadness, and anger, which are all associated with a cancer diagnosis, justifiably, significantly increase the subcortical activation. So that's the alert center, the alarm, and almost reduce the prefrontal cortex activity significantly. So that the two become completely disassociated. So that's where trauma comes from. So when the two brains are not working in tandem, they're not working harmoniously, you're relying solely on the emotional unregulated part, which is just fight or flight, threat to life, or the kind of emergency
alarm bells. Yeah.
And what happens then is your brain secretes only stress hormones, which are cortisol. And what do we know about stress is that it causes inflammation in the body, which we know is an absolute catalyst for things like cancer cells. Cancer cells thrive on inflammation. We know that inflammation is a big trigger for chronic disease such as cancer. So there's this whole knock-on effect about the trauma response when you get that initial diagnosis to your body reacting. And potentially, I would one could make an educated guess and say, if you're living in that stressed state, unable to regulate or address the trauma and regulate the hormonal state, you potentially could be further catalyzing the growth of cancer cells, because if you're in a state of stress and inflammation, that in theory catalyzes the cancer. So when we balance the two systems, so when we balance the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, and we're able to have them working harmoniously, that's when we feel normal, we feel relaxed, we feel like everything's okay. But when the limbic system decides there's a question of life or death, the pathways of the two become tenuous, and that's how you end up in this, you know, stressful state. So what are the physical consequences of this? So they manifest in the gut, the heart, and the lungs. So we can address this in two different ways. So there's top-down regulation and bottom-up regulation. So top-down regulation would be strengthening the capacity of the frontal lobe to monitor your body's sensations. So that would be things like meditation and yoga. So you're managing your prefrontal cortex to, you know, down the sensory, you know, into your body, and manage it with, you know, things like breathing, meditation, yoga, and being mindful, being present, because that's the prefrontal cortex is the present.
Yeah.
Bottom up regulation is recalibrating the autonomic nervous system. So this can be achieved through breath work, movement, and touch. So day-to-day events, what happens when you're in this trauma and stress response state? Day-to-day events become less compelling. You being able to be present stops you from being fully alive, which is a total pain in the ass if you're suffering from a cancer crisis. To be able to feel that you're not even feeling alive right now, you know, with the unknown, you know, potential death sentence in front of you. Concentration becomes more difficult again, and that's only compounded with treatment. We know the chemo brain is an absolute thing. So if you've got the effects of treatment making it harder for you to concentrate, plus your own stress response making it harder for you to concentrate, well, that's, you know, that's pretty self-explanatory how that's going to manifest. And not being present also keeps you rooted in the past, so you're unable to move forward. And I've always thought that if, you know, there's a grief process associated with the loss of oneself pre-cancer, right? That's who you are. And so you're kind of torn, you're grieving from that person that you no longer are, but you're not able to, yet able to focus on or reach into your future, because you're stuck in this purgatory of treatment and not knowing the outcome. It's, you know, you get all these percentages thrown at you, what the chances this might work and maybe this might work. So you're never able to fully focus or plan or premeditate anything going forward. So I think that's a really hard position to be in. And then there's one more factor when it comes to how the brain is operating all this, which is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Now that tells us how our present experience relates to our past, and also how it may affect our future. So you can already understand then, as somebody living with a cancer diagnosis, how those three things are completely disassociated now. You could think of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex almost as like the timekeeper of the brain. So in knowing that if something is finite, it makes it tolerable. But situations do become intolerable if they are interminable. So that's also something that we factor in, is this timekeeping part, where we don't know yet if this is going to go on forever, if it's going to end, if so, when. All of this, you know, compounds together to create this enormous stress response. So I'm looking now, because we know exercise alleviates stress. We know that putting your body into a strong pose, into taking up space, your emotional state responds to that. There was a study done. It's called The Attitude Theory of Emotion by Nina Bull. And she assessed that if you hold your body in a certain posture, your emotional set will respond to that. It is physically impossible for you to hold, let's say, a strong imposing posture and feel the opposite emotion. Equally, it would be hard for you to be holding a very soft or enclosed or introverted physical posture and immediately try and feel suddenly happy. Your body and your emotional state are interlinked. If you think about the start of a running race, they go, get ready, set, go. And it's that set position, the set posture where their bottom, right. you know, they're ready to run. And then true, but then the hormones kick in and that's the adrenaline that gets them off the mark. Hmm. You can think about that. So if we can change somebody's mental state by, first of all, changing their postural set and their body and how they, their strength, their control in their own body, that is naturally going to affect their emotional state, their ability to emotionally regulate. And I think that's a big key in, one, reducing the stress response and therefore the inflammation in cancer patients. And two, making them feel bloody happy and a bit more in control of a situation that's, let's face it, they have very little control over. And unrelated to any of the science stuff, as somebody who is a dancer, I've understood the levels of control that one can reach with one's own body. The physical limits in which you can push. Now, I'm not suggesting that we take cancer patients and make them balance on their first three toes. What I am suggesting is that having control over your body gives you a sense of control in a life of chaos. It really does. Mm. And I that is not to be underestimated.
Very interesting. So I thought one of the very interesting things about the way you described, you're giving us all these parts of the brain and what they do and the how they play into all this, and you can see, you know, a message that somebody like Sophie Savage was trying to put out quite strongly to people was that actually being realistic about your situation is not a bad thing, in as much as if you don't actually see the danger you're in, for example, you won't respond appropriately. Right. But being lost in that is not good for you either. Yeah. And so you actually need to both embrace the reality of your situation and feel empowered and rational and all the rest of it to actually say, well, what am I going to do about this? So you really need both parts, you know, because just looking at the situation is enough to take you down the pan straight away.
Yeah. Well, what's suggested is that if you've only got the subcortical area firing and the prefrontal one has sort of gone down a bit, if you've got one offline and one online, that's when trauma ends up results in sort of being stuck in the past. And that's when you think about things like PTSD, they have flashbacks and things, because the bit that controls the sort of timekeeping and the more observant regulatory side of it, the one that inhibits the irrational stuff and goes, yes, but that was then and this is now, what that bit's offline. So you're constantly living in this emotionally driven state, which means you can never fully embrace, like you say, the present and facing up to, this is my reality. So it's only when we've got all three of those systems, so the subcortical, the prefrontal, and then the dorsolateral bit, all three of those firing at the same time, they're all online together, can you fully address any potential trauma that you are currently suffering. So, and to do that, you need to be quite grounded and you need to be anchored in yourself. And I think for me, the only way to do that is in exercise, is to bring your brain into your own body in this moment and focus on it moving. And exercise is a wonderful way in which to get all of those systems working online together to be here and now. Because if you're trying to execute quite a complex movement that requires some attention, your visual attention, your coordination and strength all at the same time, it's very difficult for your brain to be somewhere else, right?
Right.
It really does have to be here with you. Otherwise, you risk falling on your face.
Literally.
or embarrassing yourself in a gym or something, you know. So everyone exercising becomes very, you know, themselves. And so that really, for me, is the only way to address that side of it.
It's very interesting. It's beautifully practical because, of course, when you start talking about different bits of the brain with clever names, it all becomes a bit abstract. But, you know, you're talking about something very practical you can do. And you can you also mentioned meditation and mindfulness is actually something very practical you can do about another aspect of the whole thing. So very interesting indeed. So look, not much time left. I just wanted you to round off by telling us a little bit about who you work with, how you work with them, so people can get an idea.
Okay. I work with anybody who is willing to, you know, put themselves on the line. No, I'm joking. I work with anybody that wishes to be present in their own journey and be stronger physically and mentally. I work with people on a one-on-one basis.
Yes.
That can be done online or in person, although at the moment it was really dependent on where I I'm a bit nomad at the moment, so I'm keeping everything online. Mm-hmm. I do think in the future there is something to be said for more community groups for these, for exercise and cancer, because we know as well that it's a lot about building a community of people around you. And exercise is a great way to bring people together. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure of the timing of this and how comfortable people feel yet exposing themselves to be with other people. But, and we know in the pandemic, it was just an absolute no-no. So that's something that could be considered in future. Okay. But for now, I work one-on-one and remotely online.
Okay. And where can listeners find out more?
On my website, rrc.care.
Okay. And RRC stands for?
Red Rehabilitation, and the C is interchangeable. It can mean clinical or corporate.
Right, I see.
I was smart in the pandemic, you see.
Very good. Okay, well, look, fascinating stuff, and all that very interesting, all the interface between the practical and our state of mind, our state of being generally. It's so important to find out more about this. So thanks very much indeed for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Great to hear so much more about the benefits of exercise, particularly in the arena of the psychological, spiritual, and emotional. Before I finish, I want to take a minute to make you aware, if you're not already, of Health Triangle magazine. Health Triangle is an online publication put out by UK Health Radio monthly, and Yes to Life features in every single edition, showcasing a selection of the guests who have featured in the Yes to Life show. So, for example, the current edition has articles from Steve Taylor, Sarah Johns, and Liz Butler, all of whom were my guests on the show, and also all of whom featured in the Yes to Life annual conference, Finding a Deeper Connection, this autumn. So it's a great place to look for more from my featured guests, but also, of course, if you have a keen interest in health generally, the magazine is packed with a vast range of material from all the presenters on UK Health Radio, and so a great resource for fresh ideas and perspectives on a healthy living. Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UK Health Radio website at ukhealthradio.com/magazine. Thanks so much for listening today. I'd love you to join me again next week when I'll be back with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.